Fred, you're keen.
Yeah. When I first read your what you were going to talk about, I didn't understand one single word of it. And not being the sharpest knife in the drawer, I took it to my branch, and there were three members, including me, that also didn't understand it. And I'd like to ask you the question, who would you think this title would attract to come to a meeting like this? And what does it mean, please?
Well, imagine a boot stomping on a human face is a quote from George Orwell. That's a reference to the state, isn't it? The state, the repressive nature of the state. Giving it straight on das state is a humorous statement. Using sort of tech speak, you know, I mean, STR8 means state, ST8 is state. Is it just the title you don't understand, Fred, or is it the whole what I've written?
Well, it's the whole lot. I mean, I didn't understand one bit of it.
Well, sorry. I think it's quite clear, actually. I've really detailed exactly what I'm going to talk about, and the subtitled headings and things like that. I mean, obviously, if you don't know what encryption means, I can understand people not knowing what maybe Tor or RiseUp.net mean, but Snoopers Charters. Sorry, I mean...
Just that giving it straight...
Is that the problem?
It didn't make any sense to me, that phrase.
That's a reference to youth culture, isn't it?
It's a light-hearted bit.
Well, I'm too old, obviously.
Yes.
not too old, maybe just disconnected in a way. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's age. Yeah. It's a different kind of connection.
I think it's age. Yeah, Kevin.
Speaking on behalf of Golden Generation for a moment, I actually think this is quite clever.
Excuse me.
I think this is pretty good because this is street speak. You know, I'm regards to street speak. I mean, I'm waiting for the day, because I think it's quite clever, this is like a text thing. I'm waiting for the day when they're not all called guys, you know. I'm also waiting for the day when the word son is not used so much, you know. I'm waiting for the day when someone says like, they say what it is like. So I approve of this. I think it's excellent that you put this in this way. Now, I've not been here for all of you at all, because I had to go out. It's feeling a bit weak. But I think what you've done is very good and is commendable. Excellent. Only time I've disagreed with you this weekend, Fred.
Thank you.
Danny,
yeah, please, yeah.
I really enjoyed the talk for the first time this weekend. I think I understood most of it. we live in a society that social relations are enforced by the state, and it's really, really good and thought-provoking to just have condensed, if you like, in about an hour. What the state's getting up to.
Yeah.
And from what I've been sort of like picking up over time and quite recently, what with your previous talk on TTIP, is that one, that how hard the state has to work to kind of keep us discreet, to keep us content and profitable, how much it has to put in. And how. And with the increase of state power, always exemplifies the increase of working class power, as perceived by the state. Because they, you know, I mean, we're the goose that lays the golden egg, but we have to be looked after. We have to be conditioned to. You know, it's not just. I mean, we have to. Yeah, they have to work on us to get us to get the golden egg. You know, we just don't give it up easily. And the other thing, you know, with the state and, you know, what's happening in different parts of the world, it's all becoming like much clearer. You know, the fog is disappearing. You know, we can actually see what's going on. And it strikes me as the state has always been the instrument of business, the instrument of commerce. And now what it seems to me is that the state and the corporation have become one. They've kind of, the corporation now has completely absorbed the state, because the state does nothing but the bidding of the corporation. But if you look at a definition of fascism as the corporate state, this is what we're getting now. It's a kind of a covert, insidious fascism.
Yeah.
It's kind of crept up on us ever since capitalism's been around. But this insidious fascism is becoming more difficult to ignore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've just noticed it just within my adult lifetime, you know, the way the state has increased its power. And I mentioned it in the talk, you know, the different acts of Parliament in the 1980s to enforce a new restructuring of capitalism. It needed to clamp down on the organised trade union movement. It needed to create public order offences, give the police extra powers. And these are the things that we're living with today, and they're still continuing. And like I say, excuses like, you know, the fear of Islamic fundamentalism leads to an increase in the power of the state. You know, we were troops on the peace, we got armed police, you know. I didn't mention, because I've run out of time, but, you know, I mean, the police are, the police want more water cannon on the streets, so we're going to get water cannon. We've got tasers killing people now, and threats to shoot people with baton rounds. So we'll have rubber bullets, water cannon, and tasers. And we've got armed police anyway. You know, they say the police aren't armed. There's lots of armed police, you know. I just go on a railway station in London, and we've got guys with machine guns walking around. You know, so we're already in that sort of, like, quasi sort of fascist state.
OK, Robert first, and then...
I was reminded, these talk, very interesting, I found it, of, especially the excursion into the historical data, that there's really not a great deal new in what the current government is doing at proposals. There's a comrade here with the Thomas Paine on his T-shirt. I think about the story of the Rights of Man. That was banned as seditious literature.
Yes, yes.
And the author, because he was completely out of the country, couldn't be sentenced to a lengthy imprisonment, was outlawed, which meant to say he could be attacked at any time without anybody breaking the law. But there's a whole series of what happened next. Laws were brought in to cut working class, if you like, newspapers, the newspaper tax, in other words, to price them out of existence. There's a whole series of trials for sedition or blasphemies extended throughout the late 18th century and throughout the early parts of the 19th century. And one man spent over 8 years in prison for refusing to pay massive fine. We have one impoverished person who was fined over £1,000. Well, you can figure the rate of that. But there's a whole season. Another thing, Thomas Spence in London, Newcastle man that came to live in London, used to issue a whole series of token coins showing on the back, praising the actions of, I was reminded when you said about the medal, praising the activities of the radicals. And Thomas Paine and Hone and others. And when he died, interestingly enough, somebody bought his stock, a very right winger, and stamped on the other side of each of the blanks a pro-government inscription. These are called now, they're fetching quite a lot of money at auction, and call them the mules, actually. But, you know, that there's nothing really new in what was happening now. It's just that it's more refined.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about is basically the impact of the French Revolution and the Pitt government's fear of Jacobin radicalism in London. I think in the late 1790s, you know, they brought in acts of Parliament for treason, seditious writing, and combination acts, i.e. workmen coming together to, like, form combinations, was made illegal. And that's early trade unionism, really, isn't it? Well, it's the state repressing radical ideas. I mean, that was during a time of war. Capitalism is still in its early infancy, really hasn't got fully things. So, like I say, it's more refined now, but it's harder, it's harsher now. I mean, the police are harsher. And I didn't get to talk about, I mean, it may come out a bit later, but, you know, the Robert Peel said the police are the public are the police. But the whole idea of policing by consent, it's actually disappearing. Even like Kim Malthouse, who's a Tory, Greater London Assembly representative, was concerned about, like, the police being distant from the public and not being part of the public, because the police live in police ghettos. They live in villages in Surrey or Hertfordshire, because they like to live together, he says, and there's a growing divide.
There's also the fact that the state set up special juries chosen to ensure that they got the right decision. It didn't work in the case of Home, so they tried him twice more. Two more special juries. It didn't work then, so they gave up.
Yeah, well, yeah, double jeopardy, haven't we?
But they later introduced it to radicals and supporters of Paine, and, well, I say supporters of Paine, there were many other people as well. But that was the thing, and of course the use of Asians provocateur and informers, and trying to place articles, pro-government articles, in radical papers, written in such a way that it appeared as though they were supporting the radicals, whereas they were attacking them. Yeah.
Okay, we've got five down to speak at the moment. First is Fran.
It's going back to this gentleman said, you know, nothing's changed from, you know, 100 years ago, but it has because of technology, so everything's far more monitored now. But one of the things that I find surprising is how surreptitiously they're doing it. You always hear about things afterwards. For instance, after the riots in London, I read an article on the net which said that basically they want, you know, they're going to set these fitness tests for police, and they want police to be on the streets because there was revolution in the air. So they wanted the boots on the streets, and in order to do that, they've made all traffic wardens enforcement officers, and also every bouncer on the West End security is an enforcement officer. We don't know this, but they have the same. It said, next time you see one of these traffic wardens, have a look on their lapels. Yes. And I was sat on the bus, and sure enough, it was Orwellian. On he gets, and I look, and it says enforcement officer. They reckon these are the people that will be doing the civilian police jobs come the time of the next riot. They'll be monitoring the CCTV, putting people under house arrest because they're enforcement officers, and then they can have the concentration of, you know, the boots on the streets for the police. So it's like afterwards you read all about these things and how they got through. Same with Labour. Apparently hundreds of laws were put in while they were in power to take away people's freedoms.
Yeah.
You only read about it afterwards. You know, nothing. So I think it's the fact of the increasing technology and the how it's been done surreptitiously, that under our noses without even realising, is the biggest threat.
Yeah, I think you might be referring to a film. There's a film called Taking Liberties. I think it was released in 2007. And it's basically a catalogue of, like, the laws and the infringements on civil liberties that actually took place during the Blair government. You've got to remember, you know, like, you know, the territorial support group of the Metropolitan Police, which is the old SPG.
Yeah.
There's only 793 officers. I mean, the 793 officers couldn't contain civil disorder in the capital city. So what you're getting, you get volunteers from the Metropolitan Police. You know, those guys who really want to bust some heads. They're the ones who volunteer. When you see all the students, when they were all, like, getting all uppity in Parliament Square, I mean, there's thousands of police there. I mean, you're not telling me there's just 793 TSG.
Yeah.
It's all the volunteers. The volunteers are the guys who want to, like, crack some heads.
Yeah. And that's a big,
you know, like the guy who killed Ian Tomlinson, who got off. He's not like a TSG operative. He's just a... He's a copper from outer borough, but he wants a bit of action, though, doesn't he? You know.
Okay, I've got Brian next, and then Vince, Janet. Did you raise your hand before? Yeah, and Carla. So, Brian first.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't understand the title, but for whatever reason. But I really enjoyed your kind of overview. You said you were going to do an overview. I thought it was really, really smashing. Just two things. One is, there's always been, since the rise of the state and the rise of inequality, a symbiotic relationship between political oppression and economic exploitation. It's always been there, actually. The two things I want to mention, one, it's international. I've done a lot of research in India and whatnot. I mean, what's happening in places like India? You've got big, particularly mining companies, timber companies, people into iron and all that. And places like Orissa and that, they're taking over the place. Okay? And what's happening, the locals are all rebellion, mostly tribal people. They're all rebellion. They're up in arms against this. What happens? The British government together with the Indian government to protect British interests, because a lot of these mining companies are British, like Vedanta and whatnot. What they get is to get in the Indian state on behalf of the British, because they can't go in and protect. The British government can't go in and protect the international multinational companies, these mining companies. What they do, they've got the British state, the Indian state, to come in and shoot the people. It's just simple. Just any rebellions or whatnot, they're just taking over the land and pushing all the tribal people off the land. So there's an international to this.
Yeah.
The other thing is there's a famous Mexican kind of anarchist. He referred to himself as a liberal called Flores Magón, and he sort of said there was an unholy trinity. There's an unholy trinity. In other words, it's not just the state and capital or political oppression and economic exploitation. There's always another thing involved, actually. Okay, and it's ideology, it's culture. And in the past, of course, it was religion. You can't just suppress people, you've got to brainwash them. I mean, even Hitler realised this. You couldn't just sort of push people around and whatnot. Somebody was talking about this on the other talks, actually. You have to work on people's ideas and on their ideologies and all that. And I think an important thing now is the media, the role of the media. It's a triad in a way. There's an unholy triad, you know. It's not just the state, it's not just capital, it's actually the media, which of course is basically controlled by the capitalists as well. And they have a fundamental role in that. So with all the stuff that's happening in India, it's quite interesting. There was a bit in The Guardian. It's never actually mentioned in the media, all those sort of things. Lots of things are going on where people are uprising. It's squashed and forgotten. Of course, on the other hand, there's all the promotion, supporting capitalism. You've only got to open a newspaper and what it is. It's all pro-capitalist, whole lot of it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's my little contribution.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't mention the media, but yeah, that triad that you mentioned, you know, the government, the police and the media, I mean, that's actually arisen recently, in recent years, hasn't it? You know, with like the hacking stuff, you know, the fall of the News of the World, you know, you see senior police officers intimately linked with, like, you know, the newspaper editors and Cameron, his aides, it's all linked up, yeah. That's actually come out, but I didn't have time to focus on the media.
Okay, thanks. Vince?
Well, I just want to make a couple of very general points. The first one is that I've been coming to summer school since about 1996, and for me, this today's talk this morning really stands out as being something special, extremely informative and useful. And my sincere hope is that when it's put on the internet, that as many people as possible see it. Because the main point I want to make here more specifically is that it completely, today's meeting completely contradicts the distortions that the general public get through the capitalist media about the decline of the state and supposedly more freedom in society. The reality, as Steve has told us this morning, is precisely the opposite. And we've had ample examples of why that's the case, from going way back into the 19th century up to the present time. So it's been highly illuminating. And I'm a member of an economics U3A close to where I live, and I'd like some of the people there who are basically very pro-capitalist and conservative-minded, I'd like them to see this. I shall certainly be sending an email out to them to try and dispel their illusions about how the state is supposedly declining. We know that is certainly not the case, and about this being a free country and all that type of garbage. if I hope, as I say, just in conclusion, that many people as possible see this talk and find out as well about the reality of the society that they live in.
Thank you, Vincent. I'm just sorry that I didn't actually finish it. I didn't finish the last section of the talk. I always do this. I'm too dense. My talks are always too dense. There's too much, and I always want to cover too many things. And I didn't really finish it off properly, so it just sort of petered out. But thank you, Vincent, for that comment.
Janet?
Yeah, I'd second that, Vincent. And I would like to say, I was starting to say that I'm really sorry you weren't able to finish it. I think a lot of us would have gladly sat here and listened to Dan. Oh,
right.
Okay.
Okay.
And along the way, I noticed there were a lot of occasions where people were laughing wryly.
Yes.
And I wonder how many of us were laughing wryly, the irony and whatever else we see in there, because if we didn't, we'd be screaming. And so, really, what I wanted to ask you is, because we didn't hear right to the end, just wonder if in there was any little ray of positive something we could look at to take away. Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do, actually. Of course, Janet. Yeah, yesterday when I was speaking to my comrade here, Robert, I was saying it's going to be really, really depressing. You know, people are going to come in with hangovers and they're going to be really, really down. And I'm just going to be like, I'm going to be that boot stamping on the human face. I really thought, and I was feeling a bit negative yesterday, and you know, probably a little bit of a hangover from Friday night. I haven't got one now, but I was thinking, oh no, this is going to be terrible if I like relate all this. And then I start talking about police as robots without souls, and we start talking about, you know, like it's going to be really bad. To be honest with you, Janet, I haven't really got much of a ray of hope. You know, I feel really quite negative, actually, about it. I mean, you know, let me just give you the last little bit of that. I mean, this thing about the police, I mean, are they workers in uniform or are they paramilitaries of the authoritarian capitalist state? But both sides are present. You know, there's a little section called the police's Janus, you know, two-faced. I mean, they are two-faced, not only in a bad way, but in a good way as well, because there's a hard cop, soft cop.
Yeah.
I mean, and they practice sort of expedient toleration. I mean, I've grown up in London, but I've lived my adult life in London. I've seen the police. Sometimes the Metropolitan Police are really all right. Mm-hmm. I've come across them, and you get a really good feeling with them sometimes. Well, I've seen them at other times, and they're appalling people, you know. So they've got this repressive function and also this sort of like this welfare sort of function. I mean, a friend of mine had a flat firebombed, and and along came the friendly LGBT Lambeth coppers. I mean, you know, it was a case of how I learned to stop worrying and love the police, because they were just great people. So, you know, there's aspects of these of the police who are like that, you know. But as I said, like, the police are they're becoming an increasingly harsher force. I mean, like you said, the technology, I think it was Fran who said, you know, they can inflict more harm and control, and they can intrude far more into our lives. But as I want to keep saying, obviously, the police protect, in a crude way, public order, but that's to protect private property. So my conclusion is to be they're far from being neutral arbiters of the capitalist state. They're active agents in enforcing state priorities, and protection of private property rights being paramount. Like at the beginning of the talk, and you know, I talk about Kafka and the film Brazil and Orwell, you know, which is all very, very gloomy, and I wanted that to see through a whole talk. I want you to have all that in your head while I was giving you all this. And no, I haven't really, the only alternative is socialism. The only way, there's no other way. We've got to abolish the state, you know, everything like that. But, you know, I can't see this, you know, like A.G. P. Taylor talks about 1945 and the state starting to, like, get its hands on into our personal lives. I mean, that's just increased. You know, the free marketeers talk about the dead hand of the state and abolishing the state. They're not. They're keeping the police and the military, and like as other comrades have said, enforcing more surveillance. So there is no alternative, really, but to, we need to, like, obviously, end private property rights, abolish the wage system, and thereby the state, which is obviously the enforcer of all these class antagonisms, will be abolished as well. That's as much as I can say.
No, that's a good answer, thank you.
There's four people down to speak at the moment. Carla's top of the list.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. You've just answered my first point, which was the police's Janus. I didn't understand that, and now I do. And going off at a tangent, I'm kind of really interested. I mean, the police are members of the working class. I'm kind of interested in their motives for wanting to do that job. I can understand the armed forces more, because usually they're recruited from areas where there's nothing else. There is no work, and they're promised to trade. So I can kind of get that if they're young and there's nothing else. But it's like, I'm interested in what motivates someone to want to be a policeman, who wants to be an agent of control. I mean, are they just control freaks, or do they think they can do a good job? Do they think it's, oh, I want to be a policeman because I want to help people? I mean, I'm quite interested in you know, but they still are members of the working class. They're not knitted people. And as such, you know, we need to convince them as well.
Hmm. Well, that's the crux of, like, the later part of the talk. And why join the police? Yeah, like, are the people who are interested in controlling other people? I always used to believe that if you wanted to join the police, you had to actually add an authoritarian personality to begin with, and you wanted to exercise authority. That's what I used to think when I was a lot younger. I understand your point about the army. Yes, I didn't mention the army, but before the police, the army was the actual organisation that maintained public order and suppressed any disorder in the working class. But the army now is used in strike breaking, you know, and it's used in, you know, say, putting out fires or collecting rubbish that's not been collected, transporting oil and things like that. But they don't actually get involved in conflict with the working class. But there is something interesting which is mentioned in the 2012 article on policing the proles in Glasgow in 1919. Obviously, the police were in conflict with the working class. And the ruling class decided to bring in the army, and at the last minute they decided not to, because they feared the Glaswegian troops going over to the side of the workers. You know, so, yeah, like I said, the army is a different thing altogether. I mean, that's another talk in itself, you know, because I don't see a role for the army in socialist society, but I see a role for, like, people who have been in the army because of the skills that they've acquired in the army, not just killing people, but the other skills. But what are the skills you need to be a policeman or policewoman?
I'd argue they're very similar these days.
To the army? I don't know. I mean, people join the army and then they get a trade. You know, I'm not an advert for be a professional, but I haven't really got an answer for you, Carla. But why join the police? You know, I just think it's bizarre. And like Robert Peel wanted, like, saying the police are the public are the police. And I don't think that is the case. Policing by consent. Even police officers, senior police officers, are saying the ending of policing by consent is coming closer. You know, the first response of the police will be tasers, rubber bullets and water cannon. This is Police Federation people saying that, and that's the police trade union. They've been saying that this year alone, that policing by consent is finishing. And going back to what Danny said about, like, the capitalism is in this stage where, you know, it needs to enforce, like, the goose that lays a golden head, you know, needs to keep doing that. So it's getting more and more repressive, and policing by consent probably could come to an end in a few decades. You never know.
But within the army, you've got the Veterans for Peace. Or within the armed forces, you've got Veterans for Peace. So there is a kind of counter movement, but the police don't have anything like that.
No. Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps they will.
Yeah,
I mean, you resign if you're in the police, don't you? You resign if you don't like what's going on around you anymore. Now, that's the only option they've got. Or keep banging away. You know, it's like any other strata of society. It's got everything, all the good things and bad things going on in whatever section you want to happen to look at. Police are no different, better or worse, I'd say.
Okay, we've got three names down at the moment. Mike first, then Ed, then Danny. So over to Mike.
All right. Just a very brief point. The film Brazil, you mentioned a couple of times, and the DVD of it's over there. So if anyone's interest has been piqued, then there's a copy of it over there. My main point was, just wanted to sort of hear your views on this. I think what one way that the state gets away with the amount of repression and oppression that it does without people sort of either noticing it or reacting against it or criticising it, is because simultaneously that the state likes to give the impression that it protects people's interests. And I mean that sort of manifests itself in different ways according to what's sort of politically and culturally acceptable. So obviously, you know, in the late 40s, you had the establishment of the welfare state, and that was presented as sort of, you know, the state looking after people. And I suppose in more recent decades, you've had things like the proliferation of health and safety legislation, which, on the one hand, you could say it protects workers from certain, you know, industrial accidents or tries to prevent that kind of thing. And I suppose our analysis would be that, you know, it does that not for the sake of the workers' own well-being. It's just to maintain the workers being productive units. Although the sort of the trend of health and safety legislation has sort of tailed off a bit. It's not quite so fashionable. And I think to some extent it's been replaced by a trend of the state seeing itself as safeguarding particular groups. And safeguarding is if you're in certain industries or businesses, that's sort of one of today's buzzwords. And I suppose examples of that are things like, legislation to avoid discrimination against disabled people or even sort of protecting vulnerable people from abuse, you know, child abuse, for example, or even things like, you know, legalising gay marriage. So the state likes to present itself as sort of protecting individual groups' interests. And I think that's one way that they sort of... it sort of sugars the pill. I don't know if maybe that's not the best way of putting it. But it's one way it sort of gets away with the oppression, I'd say. And of course, you've got that then, you know, simultaneously, you've got the state... pulling in two different directions. You've got the oppressive or the blatantly oppressive aspect of it, and you've got the sort of the softer side of it. And I was just wondering if you had any sort of thoughts on that, or if you think I'm sort of barking up the wrong tree with that observation.
No, not at all. The state getting away with the repression, you know, because it says it's protecting people's interests. I mean, that's like security instead of liberty, isn't it? I mean, we'll give you security, but we're just going to take a few of your freedoms away. I mean, that's been the case in recent times. No, absolutely not. Safeguarding particular groups, yeah. I mean, but I think the whole thing about gay marriage, you know, is like, if you are a supporter of like gay liberation, I mean, like Peter Tatchell's not like coming out in support of gay marriage because he doesn't believe in marriage as a bourgeois convention straight away. I mean, why would he? He doesn't believe in it. I mean, the reason that Cameron supports marriage and why capitalism wants marriage, I mean, they want gay people to marry because it's all part of like the control of capitalist society. I mean, I didn't mention like, you know, state control of sex and marriage, you know, because, you know, it's all part of it. So they get, you know, gay people marry, it's all part of the consensus, you know, everybody's like doing the same thing.
And it's a property contract.
Exactly, you know. I mean, Peter Tatchell comes from the old gay liberation of the late 60s, early 70s, where, like, if you're a gay man, you wouldn't get married and you didn't believe in marriage. It's a heterosexual construct. Sex and... you know, all that sort of thing about marriage, it's all part of the state. I didn't touch on it in the talk because there wasn't enough time. Health and safety, yeah, I'm saying, yeah, it has a declined a bit, doesn't it? I mean, I think it's not fashionable, isn't it? I mean, none of the Tories in the UKIP, they don't like it at all, do they? I mean, the UKIP going to power, we'd have no health and safety at work. But I think the 1974 Act is quite a major landmark in, you know, for workers, Health and Safety at Work Act, and... like I mentioned a few, like, but like I say, it's all about obviously ensuring workers are safe and also ensuring workers are more productive for a profit as well. Yeah.
Thanks. Over to you, Ed.
You mentioned that you thought the nature of the state changed after the First World War or during. I was wondering if that was in any way if you were influenced by decadence theory at all in your thinking there, because as that's quite a major part of that. But to sort of put a positive spin on it, if you like, because I found the talk very good but also slightly depressing, to explain decadence theory to those who don't know, that basically it's the theory that capitalism began to decline after the First World War, and that it's basically hit its peak and now it will be in decline from now on. I'd say generally the state will become more militaristic and strengthen itself in that way when it's most fragile, when it's most vulnerable. Mm. I mean, certainly there's a reason why all these people like Marx and Bakunin and plenty of other political revolutionaries of Europe all ended up in Britain in the 19th century. It's because the British state wasn't as worried about the working class in this country as the other European states were. So the British state was the most liberal in Europe and the most freedom-loving because it wasn't worried. Whereas on the continent, having the Paris Commune, plenty of other political uprisings. So by the state becoming worse and more controlling, more militaristic, it's actually showing its weakness. So if you like, that's an optimistic outlook on it.
Yeah, to pick up on the last point, that relates to what Danny was saying earlier about, they're more worried and the state is reduced to its core military and police functions. The nature of the state changing after World War I, where I was influenced by decadence theory. As soon as you said that, I thought of the ICC straight away, and I think you've actually confirmed that to me, because you talked to it's decomposition theory, isn't it, of capitalism after the war. No, I wasn't influenced at all by that theory. I'm not sure if I hold too much agreement with that at all, really. But no, I just pinpointed, the fact that Britain engaging in a war in 1914, had to adopt state capitalism in order to actually pursue that war. I mean, from 1914 to 1916, I think the British government under Asquith was actually operating the war as if it was a cabinet war from the 19th century, as if they were still running the Boer War or the Crimean War, and the person who actually was pursuing the war was actually the Secretary of State for War. And it was like the cabinet are just conducting a major war in Europe, but the rest of the government can carry on as business as normal. But that couldn't last, So then you get the imposition of state capitalism, the state direction of the industry in 1916. So that's where I see as A.G.P. Taylor, he sees the state getting involved in people's lives and controlling people. I know he's been a bit like flippant in some way, talking about, pub closing hours being like made earlier and beer being watered down and the street lights changing and, but these things are still with us today as well in some ways. And the 19th century, yes. I mean, I'd love to have actually spoken more about the 19th century in some way but generally, yeah, the British state was very liberal, wasn't it? I mean, I've given you instances, obviously, the police and... people like Marx and Kropotkin would come over because there was no, police, snooping around, there's no surveillance. And Europe was always seen as, it's too militaristic, Prussian and things like that. The decadence theory, decomposition and all that. No, that wasn't an influence really. I was just looking at the hard facts of World War One.
Okay, we've had about an hour and 50 minutes now. If you want to try and wrap it up within 2 hours, maybe 10 more minutes.
Not 2 hours.
2 more hours will do. Yeah, as long as they bring the dinner through here first. It's Danny next, and then Peter.
I'm going to just be cheerful, if you like. None of us are starting off from the word go. We've had experience. When I say the before war is the before art, we've got Kafka, Gilliam, Philip K. Dick, and Orwell, and loads of other people who've looked at the nature of the state. And so we shouldn't be surprised.
No.
In a sense, all this literature is, and these films have been well read, and they're in the collective memory. One of the things we know what capitalism, we know its modus operandi, how it goes about its business. But really, we didn't know, we got its name and what it does, we need to know its address. Where capitalism lives, where it gains its sustenance, it's in the psychology of workers. And really, once workers change their mind and they reject this psychology, then capital is finished. because as the working class of this world does all the necessary work, once workers change their mind as a majority and decide they want to do something else, they'll do it. You know, nothing can stop us.
Yeah.
You know, because the capitalist class has absolutely no power whatsoever. They gain their power by conditioning into us a kind of a psychology, a servile sense of psychology. And we serve them once we decide to serve ourselves. capitalism dies. That's it, it's finished. So that's a reason to be cheerful. Just to add a little bit, I remember looking at all these buildings like the Bank of England, you know, Nelson's Column, you know, the Buckingham Palace. And essentially all it is an architectural intimidation. It's working people building monuments to intimidate themselves, you know.
Yeah.
That's what's going on. And the capitalist class has to go through all this rigmarole to impose some idea to convince us that they're powerful, when really, in fact, they're powerless. Us, the ones that are powerful, we hand it over to them.
No. Okay, Peter?
In Scotland, the Nicola Sturgeon was making the point that the minimum wage, which was supposed to solve problems, is going to be become a living wage, especially when government contracts have been added, put out. So it's going to sort of tell the folk that you're going to have to pay this particular living wage. And now we have a Tory government. Mr. Osborne has still founded the Labour Party as well, because he's going to bring out an even better wage for hard-working workers, of course. And it's going to be £9 by 1920. We're not bothered about inflation in that. That's it, and this has caused a lot of confusion. So here we have this state actually saying, wait a minute now, there is a sum of money that's got to be paid here for the workers, you know, and it's left the rest of them all arguing about how they're going to have to change their policy and so on to make their offers a bit better. So is it not being a wee bit hard on the state, you know, because in a sense, they're really looking after you, and they're really doing a job of which apparently the trade unions aren't doing at the moment.
Yeah, that's an angle you failed to explore.
Yeah, when I was looking at the benefits of the state in the the state capitalist era, actually I was looking at the Blair government of 97 actually introduced the minimum wage, so it's actually that is a benefit for the working class. But it's all part of, obviously, making the worker more productive in capitalism. The minimum wage is so low. And living wage, it's so low, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what the figures are. But if it's going up, I mean, like I say, by 2020 it'll be £9 or something. I mean, what's £9? But, yes, the state has had some benefits for the working class, but fundamentally, though, it's all about making sure that the worker is productive. But it's the unproductive members of society, though, that the state is attacking now. I mean, we've got a massive reserve army of unemployed and vulnerable people who cannot work, and they're the people who are forming the 87,000 people in prisons as well. I mean, a lot of people have just been criminalised for being poor and vulnerable, in fact. This hard-working workers' shit. No. I don't know. The state has had some benefits for the working class in the state capitalist era, and that's about it, really.
Okay, is there anybody who hasn't spoken who'd like to make a comment? If not, I'll do what I should have done yesterday with Brian Gardner's talk and totally forgot, which is ask the speaker to sum up if he wants to. But within...
Yeah.
30 seconds. Well, go on then, we're being generous.
Kafka, Gilliam, Orwell, Dick, I mentioned at the beginning. I mean, they're warnings, but in fact, obviously, aspects of this fiction have become some sort of reality. In answer to Peter's question, the wages system of the new management, when it was state capitalism, there were some benefits for the working class. But I think it's the attacks on the trade unions that are really important now, because that's where the workers are organised, and we have gone back to a sort of a 19th century situation. I want to mention investor-state dispute settlement again. you know, individual states are like weaker in the globalised world economy. I think the lying, cheating nature of capitalism is quite clear with the way it uses the state. You know, they'll move the goalposts to keep people just inside the law. They'll move the goalposts so then they can prosecute people. Yes, we talked about the Janus face aspect of the police. What else, really?
Are you in favour of the state, Steve?
Oh, no.
Sorry. I wasn't sure. Sorry.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so, and it's the change since the 1980s, you know, the capitalist restructuring, you know, like that, you know, capitalism in its mad rush for profit, you know, it needs to enforce control over the working class even more. Like I say, security, not liberty, that's really the key to modern capitalism, isn't it? Security, not liberty. That's really about it, really. I'll just mention some of the sources, really, I should say. Obviously, various works by Marx and Engels, some of those quotes. Comrade Buick's Summer School 1994 presentation on Marx and Kropotkin. Brian Morris's book on Bakunin, The Philosophy of Freedom. A class war pamphlet, interestingly enough, on policing the crisis from 2012. Showing that the class war aren't actually theory light, you know, because I always thought they were quite theory light, but there's a lot of theory in there and a lot of stuff from sociologists from the 70s and 80s. Socialist Standard articles from 1957, 1971, and 2012. A Tech Tools for Activism booklet, which is all about Rise Up and other pre-email things. Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism, is a very small book worth reading. Especially about bureaucracy, that's where I pulled off some of the Kafkaesque stuff about bureaucracy in there. George McKay's Senseless Acts of Beauty, Cultures of Resistance since the 60s, about the alternative society. And obviously Kafka, Orwell. And a bit of E.P. Thompson, Making of the English Working Class, for some of the early stuff about the police and the working class. And A.J.P. Taylor's English History, 1914-45. I didn't use a PowerPoint this year. That would have been up on the screen, but that's about it, really.
Thanks very much to Steve for that excellent talk.